Side 9, The Ruby Knight, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 383. Tell reined in his panting horse. "This looks like a good place," he said. "The road narrows a little ways back there, so they'll only be able to come at us a couple at a time." "You really think they'll try to follow us?" Keurig asked. "I know Dorga. He may not know exactly who we are, but he definitely doesn't want us to get to the authorities in Hade. Dorga's very nervous about the notion of having large groups of the sheriff's men sweeping through these mountains. They have a very stout gallows in Hade." "Is that forest down there safe?" Sparhawk asked, pointing down the road. Tell nodded. "The brush is too thick to make ambushes feasible. That ravine was the last stretch that's really dangerous on this side of the mountains." "Sophronia," Sparhawk said. "Ride on down there. Keurig, you go with her." Keurig's face showed that he was about to protest, but he said nothing. He led Sophronia and the children on down the road toward the safety of the forest. "They'll come fast," Tell said. "We went past them at a dead run, and they'll be trying to catch up." He looked at the ruffian with a longbow. "How fast can you shoot that thing?" he asked. "I can have 3 arrows in the air at the same time," the fellow shrugged. "Try for 4. It doesn't matter if you hit the horses. They'll fall off the edge of the cliff and take their riders with them. Get as many as you can, and then the rest of us will charge." "Does that sound all right, Sparhawk?" "It's workable," Sparhawk agreed. He shifted the shield on his left arm and then drew his sword. Then they heard the clatter of horses' hooves coming fast along the rocky ledge on the other side of the sharp curve. Tell's archer climbed down from his horse and hung his quiver of arrows on a stunted tree at the roadside where they would be close at hand. "These are going to cost you a 1/4 crown apiece, Tell," he said calmly, drawing an arrow from the quiver and setting it to his bowstring. "Good arrows are expensive." "Take your bill to Strogan," Tell suggested. "Strogan pays very slowly. I'd rather collect from you and let you argue with him." "All right." Tell's tone was slightly sulky. "Here they come," one of the other cutthroats said, without any particular excitement. The first 2 brigands to come around the corner probably didn't even see them. Tell's laconic archer was at least as good as he had claimed to be. The 2 men fell from their saddles, one at the side of the road and the other vanishing into the gorge. Their horses ran on a few yards and then pulled up when they saw Tell's mounted men blocking the road. The archer missed one of the next pair that came around the sharp curve. "He ducked," he said. "Let's see him try to get out of the way of this one." He pulled his bow and shot again, and his arrow took the fellow in the forehead. The man tumbled over backward and lay in the road, kicking. Then the brigands came around the curve in a cluster. The archer loosed several arrows into their midst. "You'd better go now, Tell," he said. "They're coming on a little too fast." "Let's ride," Tell shouted, settling his pike under his arm in a manner curiously reminiscent of that used by armored knights. Tell's men had a peculiar assortment of weapons, but they handled them in a professional manner. Because Farron was by far the strongest and fastest horse they had, Sparhawk outdistanced the others in the 50-pace intervening stretch of road. He crashed into the center of the startled group of men, swinging his sword to the right and left in broad overhand strokes. The men he was attacking wore no mail to protect them, and so Sparhawk's blade bit deep into them. A couple of them feebly tried to hold rusty swords up to ward off his ruthless blows, but Sparhawk was a trained swordsman who could alter his point of aim even in mid-swing, and the 2 fell howling into the road, clutching at the stumps of missing right hands. A red-bearded man had been riding at the back of the ambushers. He turned to flee, but Tell plunged past Sparhawk, his blonde hair flying, his pike lowered, and the 2 disappeared around the curve. Tell's men followed along behind Sparhawk, cleaning up with brutal efficiency. Sparhawk trotted Farron around the curve. Tell, it appeared, had picked the red-bearded man out of the saddle with his pike, and the fellow lay writhing on the road with the pike protruding from his back. Tell dismounted and squatted beside the mortally wounded man. "It didn't turn out so well, did it, Dorga?" he said in an almost friendly tone. "I told you a long time ago that waylaying travelers was a risky business." Then he pulled the pike out of his former chieftain's back and calmly kicked him off the edge of the cliff. Dorga's despairing shriek faded down into the gorge. "Well," Tell said to Sparhawk, I guess that takes care of all this. Let's go on down. It's still some distance to Hade. Tell's men were disposing of the bodies of the dead and wounded ambushers by casually throwing them into the gorge. It's safe now, Tell told them. Some of you stay here and round up those people's horses. We ought to be able to get a good price for them. The rest of you come with us. Coming, Sparhawk? He led the way on down the road. The days seemed to drag on as they moved through the unpopulated mountains of central Thalesia. At one point, Sparhawk reined Farron back to ride beside Sophrenia and Flute. To me, it seems as if we've been out here on this road for 5 days at least, he said to the little girl. How long has it really been? She smiled and raised two fingers. You're playing with time again, aren't you? He accused. Of course, she said. You didn't buy me that kitten the way you promised you would, so I have to play with something. He gave up at that point. Nothing in the world was more immutable than the rising and setting of the sun, but Flute seemed able to alter those events at will. Sparhawk had seen Bavier's consternation when she had patiently explained the inexplicable to him. He decided that he did not wish to experience that personally. It seemed to be several days later, though Sparhawk would not have taken an oath to that effect, when at sunset, the flaxen-haired Tell pulled his horse in beside Farron. That smoke down there is coming from the chimneys at Hade, he said. My men and I'll be turning back here. I believe there's still a price on my head in Hade. It's all a misunderstanding, of course, but explanations are tiresome, particularly when you're standing on a ladder with a noose around your neck. Flute, Sparhawk said back over his shoulder. Has Talon done what he came here to do?
Yes.
I sort of thought so. Tell, would you do me a favor and take the boy back to Strogan? We'll pick him up on our way back. Tie him very tightly and loop a rope about his ankles and under his horse's belly. Jump him from behind and be careful, he's got a knife in his belt. There's a reason, I suppose, Tell said. Sparhawk nodded. Where we're going is very dangerous. The boy's father and I would rather not expose him to that. And the little girl? She can take care of herself. Probably better than any of the rest of us. You know something, Sparhawk? Tell said skeptically. When I was a boy, I always wanted to become a church knight. Now I'm glad I didn't. You people don't make any sense at all. It's probably all the praying, Sparhawk told him. It tends to make a man a little vague. Good luck, Sparhawk, Tell said shortly. Then he and two of his men roughly jerked Talon from his saddle, disarmed him, and tied him on the back of his horse. The names Talon called Sparhawk as he and his captors rode off to the south were wide-ranging and, for the most part, very unflattering. She doesn't really understand all those words, does she? Sparhawk asked Sophrenia, looking meaningfully at Flute.
Will you stop talking as if I weren't here? The little girl snapped. Yes, as a matter of fact, I do know what the words mean. But Aline is such a puny language to swear in. Styric is more satisfying, but if you really want to curse, try troll.
You speak troll? He was surprised.
Of course. Doesn't everyone? There's no point in going into Hade. It's a depressing place, all mud and rotting logs and mildewed thatching. Circle it to the west, and we'll find the valley we want to follow.
They bypassed Hade and moved up into steeper mountains. Flute watched intently and finally pointed one finger.
There, she said. We turn left here.
They stopped at the entrance to the valley and peered with some dismay at the track to which she had directed them. It was a path more than a road, and it seemed to wander quite a bit. It doesn't look too promising, Sparhawk said dubiously, and it doesn't look as if anybody's been on it for years.
People don't use it. Flute told him. It's a game trail. Sort of.
What kind of game?
Look there.
She pointed. It was a boulder with one flat side, and an image had been crudely chiseled into it. The image looked very old and weathered, and it was hideous. What's that? Sparhawk asked.
It's a warning, she replied calmly. That's a picture of a troll.
You're taking us into troll country? He asked in alarm.
Sparhawk, Gwerig's a troll. Where else do you think he'd live?
Isn't there any other way to get to his cave?
No, there isn't. I can frighten off any trolls we happen to run across, and the ogres don't come out in the daytime, so they shouldn't be any problem.
Ogres, too?
Of course, they always live in the same country with trolls. Everybody knows that.
I didn't.
Well, now you do. We're wasting time, Sparhawk.
We'll have to go in single file, the knight told Curic and Sophrania. Stay as close behind me as you can. Let's not get spread out. He started up the trail at a trot with the spear of Aldreas in his hand. The valley to which Flute had led them was narrow and gloomy. The steep walls were covered with tall fir trees so dark as to look nearly black, and the sides of the valley were so high that the sun seldom shone into this murky place. A mountain river rushed down the center of the narrow gap, roaring and foaming.
This is worse than the road to Gossick, Curic shouted over the noise of the river. Tell him to be still, Flute told Sparhawk. Trolls have very sharp ears.
Sparhawk turned in his saddle and laid a finger across his lips. Curic nodded. There seemed to be an inordinate number of dead white snags dotting the dark forest that rose steeply on either side. Sparhawk leaned forward and put his lips close to Flute's ear.
What's killing the trees? He asked.
Ogres come out at night and gnaw on the bark, she said. Eventually the tree dies.
I thought ogres were meat eaters.
Ogres eat anything. Can't you go any faster?
Not through here, I can't. This is a very bad trail. Does it get any better on up ahead?
After we go up out of this valley, we'll come to a flat place in the mountains.
A plateau?
Whatever you want to call it. There are a few hills, but we can go around those. It's all covered with grass.
We'll be able to make better time there. Does the plateau stretch all the way to Gwerig's cave?
Not quite. After we cross that, we'll have to go up into the rocks.
Who brought you all the way up here? You said you'd been here before.
I came alone. Somebody who knew the way told me how to get to the cave.
Why would you want to?
I had something to do there. Do we really have to talk so much? I'm trying to listen for trolls.
Sorry.
Hush, Sparhawk!
She put her finger to his lips. It was a day later when they reached the plateau. As Flute had told them, it was a vast rolling grassland with snow-covered peaks lining the horizon on all sides. How long is it going to take us to get across this? Sparhawk asked.
I'm not sure, Flute replied. The last time I was here I was on foot. The horses should be able to go much faster.
You were up here alone and on foot, with trolls and ogres about? He asked incredulously.
I didn't see any of those. There was a young bear that followed me for a few days, though. I think he was only curious, but I got tired of having him behind me, so I made him go away.
Sparhawk decided not to ask her any more questions. The answers were far too disturbing. The high grassland seemed interminable. They rode for hours, but the skyline did not appear to change. The sun sank low above the snowy peaks, and they made their camp in a small clump of stunted pines.
It's big country up here, Curic said, looking around.
He pulled his cloak closer about him.
Cold, too, once the sun goes down.
Now I can see why most Thalesians wear fur. They hobbled the horses to keep them from straying and built up the fire.
There's no real danger here in this meadow, Flute assured them. Trolls and ogres like to stay in the forest. The hunting's easier for them when they can hide behind trees.
The next morning dawned cloudy, and a chilly wind swept down from the mountain peaks, bending the tall grass in long waves. They rode hard that day, and by evening they had reached the foot of the peaks that towered white above them.
We can't make any fire tonight, Flute said. Gwerig may be watching.
Are we that close? Sparhawk asked.
You see that ravine just ahead?
Yes.
Gwerig's cave is at the upper end of it.
Why didn't we just go on up there, then?
That wouldn't have been a good idea. You can't sneak up on a troll at night. We'll wait until the sun's well up tomorrow before we start out. Trolls usually doze in the daytime. They don't actually ever really sleep, but they're a little less alert when the sun's out.
You seem to know a great deal about them.
It's not too hard to find things out, if you know the right people to ask.
Make Sophrania some tea and some hot soup. Tomorrow's likely to be very difficult for her, and she'll need all her strength.
It's a little hard to make hot soup without a fire.
Oh, Sparhawk, I know that. I'm small, but I'm not stupid. Heap up a pile of rocks in front of the tent. I'll take care of the rest.
Grumbling to himself, he did as she directed.
Get back from it, she said. I don't want to burn you.
Burn? How?
She began to sing softly, and then she made a brief gesture with one small hand.
Sparhawk immediately felt the heat radiating out from his pile of rocks.
That's a useful spell, he said admiringly.
Start cooking, Sparhawk. I can't keep the rocks hot all night.
It was very strange, Sparhawk thought, as he set Sophrania's tea kettle up against one of the heated rocks. Somehow in the past weeks he had almost begun to stop thinking of Flute as a child. Her tone and manner were adult, and she ordered him around like a lackey. Even more surprising was the fact that he automatically obeyed her. Sophrania was right, he decided. This little girl was in all probability one of the most powerful magicians in all of Styricum. A disturbing question came to him. Just how old was Flute, anyway? Could Styric magicians control or modify their ages? He knew that neither Sophrania nor Flute would answer those questions, so he busied himself with cooking and tried not to think about it. They awoke at dawn, but Flute insisted that they wait until mid-morning before they attempted to ascend the ravine. She also instructed them to leave the horses at the camp, since the sound of their hoofs on the rock might alert the sharp-eared troll lurking inside the cave. The ravine was narrow with sheer sides, and it was filled with dense shadows. The four of them moved slowly up its rocky floor, placing their feet carefully to avoid dislodging any loose stones. They spoke but rarely, and then only in whispers. Sparhawk carried the ancient spear. For some reason it seemed right. The climb grew steeper, and they were forced to clamber over rounded boulders now in order to continue their ascent. As they neared the top, Flute motioned them to a halt and crept on ahead a few yards. Then she came back.
"He's inside," she whispered, "and he's already started his enchantments."
"Is the cave mouth blocked?" Sparhawk whispered back.
"In a manner of speaking. When we get up there, you won't be able to see it. He's created an illusion to make it look as if the mouth of the cave is just a part of the cliff face. The illusion is solid enough so that we won't be able just to walk through it. You'll need to use the spear to break through."
She whispered for a moment to Sophrania, and the small woman nodded.
"All right, then," Flute said, taking a deep breath. "Let's go."
They climbed up the last few yards and entered a bleak, unwholesome-looking basin choked with brambles and dead white snags. On one side of the basin there was a steep overhanging cliff that did not appear to have any openings in it.
"There it is," Flute whispered.
"Are you sure this is the right place?" Kurok murmured. "It looks like solid rock."
"This is the place," she replied. "Gwerig's hiding the entrance."
She led the way along a scarcely defined path to the face of the cliff.
"It's right here," she said softly, laying one small hand on the rock. "Now this is what we're going to do. Sophrania and I are going to cast a spell. When we release it, it's going to pour into you, Sparhawk. You'll feel very strange for a moment, and then you'll feel the power starting to build up inside you. At the right moment, I'll tell you what to do."
She began to sing very softly, and Sophrania spoke in Styric almost under her breath. Then, in unison, they both gestured at Sparhawk. His eyes went suddenly dim, and he almost fell. He felt very weak, and the spear he held in his left hand seemed almost too heavy to bear. Then, just as quickly, it seemed to have no weight at all. He felt his shoulders surging with the force of the spell.
"Now," Flute said to him, "point the spear at the face of the cliff."
He lifted his arm and did as she had told him.
"Walk forward until the spear touches the wall."
He took two steps and felt the spear point touch the unyielding rock.
"Release the power through the spear."
He concentrated, gathering the power within him. The ring on his left hand seemed to throb. Then he sent the power along the shaft of the spear into the broad blade. The seemingly solid rock in front of him wavered. Then it was gone.
revealing an irregularly shaped opening.
"And there it is," Flute said in a triumphant whisper. "Werig's cave. Now let's go find him."
Chapter 25. The cave had the musty smell of long damp earth and rock, and there was the sound of water endlessly dripping somewhere off in the darkness. "Where's he most likely to be?" Sparhawk whispered to Flute.
"We'll start in his treasure chamber," she replied. "He likes to look at his hoard. It's down there."
She pointed at the opening of a passageway. "It's completely dark back in there," he said dubiously.
"I'll take care of that," Sophronia told him. "But quietly," Flute cautioned. "We don't know exactly where Werig is, and he can hear and feel magic."
She looked closely at Sophronia.
"Are you all right?"
she asked.
"It's not as bad as it was,"
Sophronia replied, shifting Sir Garrod's sword to her right hand.
"Good. I'm not going to be able to do anything in here. Werig would recognize my voice. You're going to have to do almost everything."
"I can manage," Sophronia said, but her voice sounded weary. She held up the sword.
"As long as I have to carry this anyway, I may as well use it."
She muttered briefly and made a small motion with her left hand. The tip of the sword began to glow, a tiny incandescent spark.
"It's not much of a light," she said critically, "but it's going to have to do. If I made it any brighter, Werig would see it."
She raised the sword and led the way into the mouth of the gallery.
The glowing tip of the sword looked almost like a firefly in the oppressive darkness, but it cast just enough faint light to make it possible for them to find their way and avoid obstructions on the rough floor of the passageway they were following.
The passage curved steadily downward and to the right. After they had gone a few hundred paces, Sparhawk realized that it was not a natural gallery, but had been carved out of the rock, and it moved in a steady spiral down and down.
"How did Werig make this?" he whispered to Flute. "He used Belium. The old passage is much longer, and it's very steep. Werig's so badly deformed that it used to take him days to climb up out of the cave."
They moved on, walking as quietly as they could. At one point, the gallery passed through a large cavern where limestone icicles hung from the ceiling, dripping continually. Then the passage continued on into the rock. Occasionally, their faint light disturbed a colony of bats hanging from the ceiling, and the creatures chittered shrilly as they flapped frantically away in huge, dark clouds.
"I hate bats," Curic said with an oath. "They won't hurt you," Flute whispered. "A bat will never run into you, not even in total darkness."
"Are their eyes that good?"
"No, but their ears are."
"Do you know everything?" Curic's whisper sounded a little grumpy.
"Not yet," she said quietly, "but I'm working on that. Do you have anything to eat? I'm a little hungry for some reason."
"Some dried beef," Curic replied, reaching inside the tunic that covered his black leather vest. "It's very salty, though."
"There's plenty of water in this cave."
She took the chunk of leather-hard beef he offered and bit into it.
"It is a little salty, isn't it?" she admitted, swallowing hard.
They moved on. Then they saw a light coming from somewhere ahead, faint at first, but growing steadily stronger as they moved on down the spiral gallery.
"His treasure cave is just ahead," Flute whispered. "Let me have a look."
She crept on ahead and then returned.
"He's there,"
she said, her face breaking into a smile.
"Is he making that light?" Curic whispered. "No, it comes down from the surface. There's a stream that drops down into the cavern. It catches the sunlight at certain times of the day."
She was speaking in a normal tone now.
"The sound of the waterfall will muffle our voices. We still have to be careful, though. His eyes will catch any movement."
She spoke briefly to Sophronia. The small Styric woman nodded. She reached up and extinguished the spark at the tip of the sword between two fingers. Then she began to weave an incantation.
"What's she doing?" Sparhawk asked Flute. "Werig's talking to himself," she replied, "and it might just be that he'll say something useful to us. He's speaking in the language of the trolls, so Sophronia is making it possible for us to understand him."
"You mean that she's going to make him speak in Aline?"
"No, the spell isn't directed at him."
She smiled that impish little smile of hers.
You're learning many things, Sparhawk. Now you'll understand the language of the trolls. For a time, at least.
Sophronia released the spell, and quite suddenly Sparhawk could hear much more than he had during their long descent through the spiraling gallery. The rushing sound of the waterfall dropping into the cavern ahead became almost a roar, and Gwerig's rasping mutter came clearly over it.
"We'll wait here for a time," Luke told them. "Gwerig's an outcast, so he talks to himself most of the time, and he says whatever is crossing his mind. We can find out a great deal by eavesdropping. Oh, by the way, he has Sarek's crown and Belium still attached to it."
Sparhawk felt a sudden rush of excitement. The thing he had sought for so long was no more than a few hundred paces away.
"What's he doing?" he asked Flute. "He's sitting at the edge of the chasm that the waterfall has carved out of the rock. All his treasures are piled up around him. He's cleaning the peat stains off of Belium with his tongue. That's why we can't understand him at the moment. Let's move a little closer, but stay back from the mouth of the gallery."
They crept on down toward the light and stopped a few yards from the opening. The reflected light from the waterfall shimmered and seemed to waver liquidly. It was peculiarly like a rainbow.
"Stealers! Thieves!"
The voice was harsh, far harsher than any Elanian or Styric throat could have produced.
"Dirty! She all dirty!"
There was more of the slobbering sound as the troll dwarf licked at his treasure.
"Stealers all dead now,"
Gwerig chortled hideously.
"All dead. Gwerig not dead, and his rose come home at last."
"He sounds as if he's mad," Curic muttered.
"He always has been," Fluke told him. "His mind's as twisted as his body."
"Talk to Gwerig, Blue Rose,"
the unseen monstrosity commanded.
Then he howled out a hideous oath directed at the Styric goddess Afrael.
"Bring back rings! Bring back rings! Belium not talk to Gwerig if Gwerig not got rings."
There was a blubbering sound, and Sparhawk realized with revulsion that the beast was crying.
"Lonely,"
the troll sobbed.
"Gwerig so lonely."
Sparhawk felt a wrench of almost unbearable pity for the misshapen dwarf.
"Don't do that," Flute said sharply. "It will weaken you when you face him. You're our only hope now, Sparhawk, and your heart must be like stone."
Then Gwerig spoke for a time in terms so vile that there were no counterparts in the Elanian language.
"He's invoking the troll gods," Flute explained quietly.
She cocked her head.
"Listen," she said sharply. "The troll gods are answering him."
The muted roar of the waterfall seemed to change tone, becoming deeper, more resonant.
"We'll have to kill him very soon,"
the little girl said in a chillingly matter-of-fact tone.
"He still has some fragments of the original sapphire left in his workshop. The troll gods instructed him to make new rings. Then they'll infuse them with the force to unlock the power of Belium. He'll be able to destroy us at that point."
Then Gwerig chuckled hideously.
"Gwerig beat you, Azash. Azash a god, but Gwerig beat him. Azash not ever see Belium now."
"Can Azash possibly hear him?" Sparhawk asked.
"Probably," Sophronia said calmly. "Azash knows the sound of his own name. He listens when somebody says something to him."
"Man things swim in lake to find Belium," Gwerig rambled on. "Bug thing belong Azash watch from weeds and see them. Man things go away. Bug thing bring man things with no minds. Man things swim in water, many drown. One man thing find Belium. Gwerig kill man thing and take Blue Rose. Azash want Belium? Azash come seek Gwerig. Azash cook in troll god fire. Gwerig never eat god meat before. Gwerig wonder how god meat taste."
Deep within the earth there was a rumbling sound, and the floor of the cave seemed to shudder. "Azash definitely heard him," Sophronia said. "You almost have to admire that twisted creature out there. No one has ever thrown that kind of insult into the face of one of the elder gods."
"Azash mad at Gwerig," the troll was saying. "Or maybe so Azash shake from fear. Gwerig have Belium now. Soon make rings. Werig not need troll gods then. Cook Azash in Beliom fire. Cook slow, so juice not burn away. Werig eat Azash. Who is prey to Azash when Azash deep in Werig's belly?
The rumble this time was accompanied by sharp cracking sounds as rocks deep in the earth shattered.
He's sticking his neck out, wouldn't you say? Kurik said in a strained voice. Azash isn't the sort you want to play with.
The troll gods are protecting Werig, Sophrenia replied. Not even Azash would risk a confrontation with them.
Stealers! All stealers!
The troll howled.
Afrael, steal rings. Adion of Thalasia, steal Beliom. Now Azash and Sparhawk from Elenia try to steal her from Werig again. Talk to Werig, Blue Rose. Werig lonely.
How did he find out about me? Sparhawk was startled by the breadth of the troll dwarf's knowledge.
The troll gods are old and very wise, Sophrenia replied. There's very little that happens in the world that they don't know, and they'll pass it on to those who serve them. For a price?
What sort of price would satisfy a god?
Pray that you never have to know, dear one, she said with a shudder.
Take Werig 10 years to carve one petal here, Blue Rose. Werig loved Blue Rose. Why she not talk to Werig?
He mumbled inaudibly for a time.
Rings. Werig make rings, so Beliom speak again. Burn as ash in Beliom fire. Burn Sparhawk in Beliom fire. Burn Afrael in Beliom fire. All burn. All burn. Then Werig eat.
I think it's time for us to get to it, Sparhawk said grimly. I definitely don't want him getting into his workshop.
He reached for his sword.
Use the spear, Flute told him. He can grab your sword out of your hand, but the spear has enough power to hold him off. Please, my noble father, try to stay alive. I need you.
I'm doing my very best, he told her.
Father? Kurik asked in a tone of surprise.
It's a Styric form of address, Sophrenia said rather quickly, throwing a look at Flute. It has to do with respect and love.
At that point, Sparhawk did something he had seldom done before. He set his palms together in front of his chest and bowed to the strange Styric child. Flute clasped her hands together in delight, then hurled herself into his arms and kissed him soundly with her rosebud little mouth.
Father, she said.
For some reason, Sparhawk felt profoundly embarrassed. Flute's kiss was not that of a little girl.
How hard is a troll's head? Kurik asked Flute gruffly. Obviously as disturbed as Sparhawk by the little girl's open display of affection that seemed far beyond her years. He was shaking out his brutal chain mace.
Very, very hard, she told him.
We've heard that he's deformed, Kurik continued. How good are his legs?
Weak. It's all he can do to stand.
All right then, Sparhawk, Kurik said in a professional tone. I'll edge around to the side of him and whip him across the knees, hips, and ankles with this. He swung his mace whistling through the air. If I can put him down, shove the spear into his guts, and then I'll try to brain him.
Must you be so graphic, Kurik? Sophrenia protested in a sick voice.
This is business, little mother, Sparhawk told her. We have to know exactly what we're going to do, so don't interfere. All right, Kurik. Let's go.
Quite deliberately, he walked to the mouth of the gallery and stepped out into the cavern, making no attempt to conceal himself. The cavern was a place of wonder. Its roof was lost in purple shadow, and the seething waterfall plunged in glowing golden mist into an unimaginably deep chasm, from which the hollow roar of falling water echoed up in endless babble. The walls, stretching out as far as the eye could reach, glittered with flecks and veins of gold, and gems more precious than the ransom of kings sparkled in the shifting rainbow-hued light. The misshapen troll dwarf, shaggy and grotesque, squatted at the edge of the chasm. Piled around him were lumps and chunks of pure gold, and heaps of gems of every hue. In his right hand, Werig held the stained gold crown of King Sarek, and surmounting that crown was Beliom, the sapphire rose.
The jewel seemed to glow as it caught and reflected the light that came tumbling down with the falling water. Sparhawk looked for the first time at the most precious object on earth, and for a moment, a kind of wonder almost overcame him. Then he stepped forward, the ancient battle spear held low in his left hand. He wasn't sure if Sophrenia's spell would make it possible for the grotesque troll to understand him, but he felt a peculiar moral compunction to speak. Simply to destroy this deformed monstrosity without a word was not in Sparhawk's nature. "I have come for Belium," he said. "I am not Adyan, king of Thalesia, so I will not try to trick you. I will take what I want from you by main force. Defend yourself if you can." It was as close as Sparhawk could come to a formal challenge under the circumstances. Gwerig came to his feet, his twisted body hideous, and his flat lips peeled back from his yellow fangs in a snarl of hatred.
"You not take Gwerig's Belium from him, Sparhawk from Elenia. Gwerig kill first. Here you die, and Gwerig eat. Not even pale Aline God save Sparhawk now."
"That hasn't been decided yet," Sparhawk replied coolly. "I need the use of Belium for a time, and then I will destroy it to keep it out of the hands of Azash. Surrender it up to me, or die." Gwerig's laughter was hideous.
"Gwerig die? Gwerig immortal, Sparhawk from Elenia. Man-thing cannot kill."
"That also hasn't been decided yet." Quite deliberately, Sparhawk took the spear in both hands and advanced on the troll dwarf. Kurek, his spiked chain mace hanging from his right fist, came out of the mouth of the gallery and edged around his lord to come at the troll from the side.
"Two?" Gwerig said. "Sparhawk should have brought 100.
He bent and lifted a huge stone club bound with iron out of a pile of gems.
"You not take Gwerig's Belium from him, Sparhawk from Elenia. Gwerig kill first. Here you die and Gwerig eat. Not even Afrael save Sparhawk now. Little man things doomed. Gwerig feast this night. Roasted man things have much juice."
He smacked his lips grossly. He straightened, his rough-furred shoulders bulking ominously. The term dwarf, as applied to a troll, Sparhawk saw, was grossly deceptive. Gwerig, despite his deformity, was at least as tall as he, and the troll's arms, twisted like old stumps, hung down below his knees. His face was furred rather than bearded, and his green eyes seemed to glow malevolently. He shambled forward, his vast club swinging in his right hand. In his left, he still clutched Sarek's crown with Belium glowing at its apex. Kurek stepped in and swung his whistling chain mace at the monster's knees, but Gwerig almost disdainfully blocked the blow with his club.
"Flee, weak man-thing," he said, his voice grating horribly. "All flesh is food for me."
He swung his horrid club at that point, and the reach of his abnormally long arms made him doubly dangerous. Kurek jumped back as the iron-bound stone cudgel whistled past his face. Sparhawk lunged in, driving the spear at the troll's chest, but again Gwerig deflected the stroke.
"Too slow, Sparhawk from Elenia,"
he laughed. Then Kurek's mace caught him high on the left hip. Gwerig fell back, but with cat-like speed smashed his club into a pile of glittering gems, spraying them out like missiles. Kurek winced and put his free hand to his face to wipe the blood from a gash in his forehead out of his eyes. Sparhawk jabbed again with his spear, lightly slicing the off-balance troll across the chest. Gwerig roared with rage and pain, then stumbled forward with vast swings of his club. Sparhawk jumped back, coolly watching for an opening. He saw that the troll was totally without fear. No injury short of one that was mortal would make the thing retreat. Gwerig was actually foaming at the mouth now, and his green eyes glowed with madness. He spat out hideous curses and lurched forward again, swinging his horrid club. "Keep him away from the edge," Sparhawk shouted to Kurek. "If he goes over, we may never find the crown." Then he quite clearly realized that he had found the key. Somehow they had to make the deformed troll drop the crown. It was obvious by now that not even the two of them could prevail against this shaggy creature with its long arms and its eyes ablaze with insane rage. Only a distraction would give them the opportunity to leap in and deliver a mortal wound.
He shook his right hand to get Keurig's attention, then reached over and clapped the hand on his left elbow. Keurig's eyes looked puzzled for a moment, but then they narrowed and he nodded. He circled around to Gwerig's left, his mace at the ready. Sparhawk tightened his grip on the spear with both hands again and feinted with it. Gwerig swung his club at the extended weapon and Sparhawk jerked it back.
"Gwerig's rings!" the troll shouted in triumph. "Sparhawk from Elenia brings the rings back to Gwerig. Gwerig, feel their presence."
With a hideous roar, he leaped forward, his club tearing at the air. Keurig struck, his spiked chain mace tearing a huge chunk of flesh from the troll's massive left arm. Gwerig, however, paid little heed to the injury, but continued his rush, his club whistling as he bore down on Sparhawk. His left hand was still tightly locked on the crown. Sparhawk gave ground grudgingly. He had to keep the troll away from the brink of the chasm for as long as he held the crown. Keurig swung his mace again, but Gwerig shied away and the blow missed the shaggy elbow. It appeared that the first stroke had caused the troll more pain than had been evident. Sparhawk took advantage of that momentary flinch and stabbed quickly, opening a gash in Gwerig's right shoulder. Gwerig howled, more in rage than in pain, and immediately swung the club again. Then from behind him, Sparhawk heard the sound of Flute's voice rising clear and bell-like above the muted roar of the waterfall. Gwerig's eyes went wide, and his brutish mouth gaped.
"You!" he shrieked. "Now, Gwerig, pay you back, girl child. Girl child's song ends here."
Flute continued to sing, and Sparhawk risked a quick glance over his shoulder. The little girl stood in the mouth of the gallery with Sophronia hovering behind her. Sparhawk sensed that the song was not in fact a spell, but rather was intended to distract the dwarf so that either he or Keurig could catch the monster off guard. Gwerig hobbled forward again, swinging his club to force Sparhawk out of his path. The troll's eyes were fixed on Flute, and his breath hissed between his tightly clenched fangs. Keurig crashed his mace into the monster's back, but Gwerig gave no indication that he even felt the stroke as he bore down on the Styric child. Then Sparhawk saw his opportunity. As the troll passed him, the wide swings of the stone club left the hairy flank open. He struck with all his strength, driving the broad blade of the ancient spear into Gwerig's body just beneath the ribs. The troll dwarf howled as the razor-sharp blade penetrated his leathery hide. He tried to swing his club, but Sparhawk jumped back, jerking the spear free. Then Keurig whipped his chain mace at the deformed side of Gwerig's right knee, and Sparhawk heard the sickening sound of breaking bone. Gwerig toppled, losing his grip on his club. Sparhawk reversed his grip on the spear and drove it down into the troll's belly. Gwerig screamed, clutching at the spear with his right hand as Sparhawk wrenched it back and forth, slicing the sharp blade through the troll's entrails. The crown, however, still remained tightly clenched in that twisted left hand. Only death, Sparhawk saw, would release that iron grip. The troll rolled away from the spear, gashing himself open even more horribly as he did so. Keurig smashed him in the face with the mace, crushing out one of his eyes. With a hideous howl, the monster rolled toward the brink of the chasm, scattering his hoarded jewels in the process. Then, with a scream of triumph, he toppled over the edge with Sarek's crown still in his grip. Filled with chagrin, Sparhawk rushed to the brink of the abyss and stared down in dismay. Far below, he could see the deformed body plunging down and down into the unimaginable darkness. Then he heard the light patter of bare feet on the stony floor of the cavern, and Flute sped past him, her glossy black hair flying. To his horror, the little girl did not hesitate nor falter, but ran directly off the edge and plunged down after the falling troll. "Oh, my God!" he choked, reaching vainly out toward her, even as Keurig, his face aghast, came up beside him. And then Sophronia was there, Sir Garrod's sword still in her hand. "Do something, Sophronia," Keurig pleaded.
"There's no need, Keurig," she replied calmly. "Nothing can happen to her."
"But hush, Keurig, I'm trying to listen." The light from the glowing waterfall seemed to dim somewhat, as if far overhead a cloud had passed over the sun. The roar of the falling water seemed mocking now, and Sparhawk realized that tears were streaming down his cheeks. Then,
In the deep darkness of that unimaginable abyss, he saw what appeared to be a spark of light. It grew steadily brighter, rising, or so it seemed, from that ghastly chasm. And as it rose, he could see it more clearly. It appeared to be a brilliant shaft of pure white light, topped by a spark of intense blue. Belium rose from the depths, resting on the palm of Flute's incandescent little hand. Sparhawk gaped in astonishment as he realized that he could see through her, and that what had risen glowing from the darkness below was as insubstantial as mist. Flute's tiny face was calm and imperturbable as she held the sapphire rose over her head with one hand. She reached out with the other to Sophronia. To Sparhawk's horror, his beloved tutor stepped off the ledge. But she did not fall. As if walking on solid earth, she calmly strolled out across the bottomless gulf of air to take Belium from Flute's hand. Then she turned and spoke in a strangely archaic form. "Wrench open thy spear, Sir Sparhawk, and put the ring of thy queen upon thy right hand, lest Belium destroy thee when I deliver it up to thee." Beside her, Flute lifted her face in exultant song, a song that rang with the voices of multitudes. Sophronia reached out a hand to touch that insubstantial little face in a gesture of infinite love. Then she walked back across the emptiness with Belium held lightly between her two palms. "Here endeth thy quest, Sir Sparhawk," she said gravely. "Reach forth thy hands to receive Belium from me, and from my child goddess, Afrael." And quite suddenly, everything became clear. Sparhawk fell to his knees with Curic beside him, and the knight accepted the sapphire rose from Sophronia's hands. She knelt between the two of them in adoration, as they gazed at the glowing face of the one they had called Flute. The eternal child goddess Afrael smiled at them, her voice still raised in choral song that filled all the cave with shimmering echoes. The light that filled her misty form grew brighter and brighter, and she speared upward faster than any arrow. Then she vanished. Here ends The Ruby Knight, Book 2 of David Edding's splendid fantasy, The Elenium. Watch for the surprising conclusion in Book 3, The Sapphire Rose, forthcoming from Del Rey Books. End of The Ruby Knight, Book 2 of The Elenium, by David Eddings.